So imagine this. You come home from the store, you unpack the canvas bags on the kitchen counter, and suddenly your stomach just drops.
Oh no, let me guess.
Yeah, you realize you forgot the bread. And it's a tiny thing, right? Like a totally meaningless slip up in the grand scheme of an entire week. And your partner, to their credit, they don't yell, they don't say a single crossword, but then it begins. The symphony of the dishes.
Oh wow, yes. That is such a vivid picture. They start putting away the clean mugs and plates with this, I mean, it's just this passive aggressive thoroughness.
Exactly.
Every cabinet door clicks shut, every fork dropped into the drawer is suddenly breathing this like unspoken heavy
It
accusation.
is so much louder than actual screaming. And within an hour, you aren't talking about a missing loaf of sourdough anymore. You are standing in the middle of the kitchen having a full-blown existential blowout.
Right, about, who carries the mental load and who can never be counted on.
Who is destined to die alone? I mean, you start at the grocery store and somehow you end up attacking the core structural integrity of your shared existence.
Yeah, and it's a scene that plays out in millions of kitchens, honestly. And it leaves people wondering how they went from 0 to 100 over, baked goods.
It's wild.
It really is. And that precise second where the emotional explosion completely wildly mismatches the tiny trigger that caused it, that is our focus today.
Yes, because today, for this deep dive, we are looking at a brilliant essay by the psychotherapist Dirk Werner. It's called Projection in Relationships: When Your Partner Becomes a Screen.
Such a good title.
It really is. And our goal today is to help you decode these hidden, totally unconscious scripts that are actually running your arguments and, well, figure out how to break the cycle of endless, exhausting bickering.
Right. Because to understand what's really happening in that kitchen argument, we have to kind of leave the realm of the everyday. I mean, you aren't fighting about bread anymore at that point.
No, not at all.
You were fighting a psychological phantom.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the word Werner uses for this phantom is projection. And I feel like that term gets thrown around constantly in pop psychology
Oh,
today.
absolutely. It's everywhere.
Usually as a weapon in an argument, right? But clinically, it goes much deeper than, internet comment sections.
It really does.
Yeah.
To get to the clinical root, we actually have to look back to the origins of psychoanalysis. So Sigmund Freud introduced the concept originally.
Right.
He used it to describe how we take an uncomfortable feeling or an impulse that actually belongs to us, and we perceive it as existing out in the world in someone else. But it was Carl Jung who made this concept incredibly useful for understanding romantic relationships.
How so?
Well, by focusing heavily on the idea of the shadow.
Ah, the shadow, the psychological basement where we hide everything we don't want to be.
Exactly. Think about the mechanics of growing up.
Yeah.
Everyone in their earliest childhood learns that certain traits are simply unacceptable if they want to, receive love, care, and safety from their parents.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So if you were a child who expressed anger, maybe you were punished or sent away, you're developing brain wires, a very clear association. Anger is dangerous. I cannot be angry and survive in this family.
Right. Or if you were needy, maybe you were ignored. So you learn that needing things makes you weak or annoying. So you learn to repress those traits entirely.
Yes. You banish the laziness, the anger, the neediness, or the selfishness into your shadow. But here is the critical mechanism, and this is what people miss. Those traits do not disappear just because you refuse to look at them.
They're still there.
They are a core part of human nature. So because you've suppressed them, they build up this enormous psychological pressure in your subconscious. They desperately need a release valve.
Wow, okay.
And involuntarily, like completely without your conscious permission, your brain finds these exact flaws, fully formed, sitting right in the face of the person closest to you, your partner.
Okay, I have an analogy for this. It's like having a massive, embarrassing piece of spinach stuck in your own teeth.
Oh, that's good.
But instead of realizing it's ours in your mouth, you look in the bathroom mirror and you start screaming at your partner who happens to be standing behind you in the reflection.
Yes.
You're just berating them for looking messy and unprofessional, when really you are viciously attacking the exact thing in them that you most fear and loathe in yourself.
That visual captures the dynamic perfectly. I mean, you are fighting your own inner demons, but you have unknowingly pasted your partner's face onto them.
That is so unfair to the partner.
It is. And this brings us to an uncomfortable but incredibly useful rule of thumb that Werner outlines. He argues that whatever outrages us disproportionately in someone else always demands a ruthless, honest look inward.
Because if it was just about the bread, you'd just be slightly annoyed.
Right.
It's the disproportion, that world-ending fury, that proves it's your shadow talking. Now, obviously, not every criticism is a projection, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
If someone leaves the trash out for 3 days, they are genuinely being unreliable.
Right. But when the outrage carries this strange, cutting moral edge, like when it feels like a reckoning of their entire character, that is the shadow using their real flaw as a convenient movie screen.
Exactly. It is the emotional intensity that gives away the ghost. The trigger is real, but the ammunition is all yours.
Okay, but wait, I have to push back on this a little bit.
Sure, go for it.
If projection is all about dumping our dark, unwanted, toxic garbage onto our partners, why are the first few months of a relationship so blissfully perfect?
Yeah.
Because we don't see any of their flaws in the honeymoon phase, where
yeah.
everything is golden, the shadow doesn't seem to exist yet.
What's fascinating here is that the human brain doesn't just project darkness. It is equally capable of projecting blindingly bright light.
Really?
Yeah. Jung called this second type of projection the anima and animus. It is the projection of an inner, absolute ideal. We basically have a blueprint of the perfect protector, nurturer, or partner sitting in our subconscious.
Okay, but where does that blueprint even come from?
It's a mosaic, really. We start sketching it out in childhood based on our unmet needs, you know, the best traits of our early caregivers, and even cultural ideals or fairy tales.
So we build this flawless template of someone who will finally make us feel entirely complete and perfectly understood.
Precisely. And when you fall in love, to a very large degree, what your brain is actually doing is recognizing its own perfect template and just plastering it over the face of a complete stranger.
Wait, are you saying early love is just a biochemical and psychological scam? Like, we aren't even falling in love with a real person. We're just falling in love with our own reflection.
I mean, it's tempting to see it as a trick.
Yeah.
But psychoanalysts view it more as a necessary psychological painkiller.
A painkiller?
Yeah. Think about how fundamentally terrifying true intimacy is.
Mm-hmm.
To completely lower your defenses and expose your most vulnerable, flawed self to a total stranger. That involves a massive amount of psychological risk.
Oh, definitely.
Your nervous system would normally reject that level of vulnerability immediately. So your brain needs a way to bridge that terrifying gap.
Ah, I get it. The flawless projection acts as an anesthetic against the terror of vulnerability.
Exactly.
You feel like you've known them forever because you actually have. You've known your own inner ideal forever. It gives you the courage to jump.
Yes. That glowing aura is what gets you to commit, which means, inevitably, the anesthetic wears off.
Of course it does.
The flawless god or goddess leaves their dirty socks on the floor, they chew too loudly, or, as we said, they forget the bread. The image cracks, and the disillusionment sets in.
And usually we view this disillusionment as a massive failure. You think, oh, the magic is gone, I chose the wrong person, the relationship is dying.
But Werner argues the complete opposite. Disillusionment isn't the failure of love. It is the exact, precise moment the projection fades. And the real, breathing, flawed human being is finally revealed.
That's a beautiful way to look at it.
Right. Only when the screen falls away does true, actual love have the chance to begin. You're finally forced to decide whether you want to love a reality or mourn an image.
Wow. You have to lose the fairy tale to get something real. But here's where it gets really interesting, though.
Okay.
Up until now, we've been talking about projection as something that just happens inside your own head. You project an angel, or you project a demon onto your partner. But sometimes your internal movie starts to actively rewrite your partner's actual personality in the real world.
Oh, yes. We are moving from classical projection into a much more dangerous dynamic here.
What's it called?
Psychoanalysts call this projective identification, a term coined by Melanie Klein, or, as Jörg Willey called it in his work with couples, collusion. This is the moment the screen talks back.
Meaning the partner doesn't just passively receive the projection?
Right. They start acting it out.
They begin to live out the role you have unconsciously forced upon them. Okay, let's go back to the kitchen and that argument over the bread to look at the hidden mechanics of this.
Let's do it.
Let's say the man in this relationship carries a deep childhood wound of abandonment. He learned very early on that he cannot rely on anyone. His internal radar is constantly scanning for proof that he's going to be let down again.
So he expects to be disappointed.
Mm.
And to protect himself from that inevitable pain, he unconsciously becomes the hyper-controlling, over-functioning manager of the relationship.
Right. He handles the bills. He plans the trips. He reminds her 3 times to buy the groceries. He makes himself indispensable to avoid being abandoned.
And if she's constantly being managed, she's going to feel that heavy, unspoken expectation that she's going to mess up anyway.
Yeah. She senses that he fundamentally does not trust her to be competent.
Exactly. And partly out of defiance and partly out of sheer convenience, because he's going to double check everything anyway,
yeah.
She steps back.
She stops trying so hard.
Right. And over months or years, she actually becomes unreliable.
It becomes a literal self-fulfilling prophecy. His inner fear of abandonment has infected her reality and molded her into the exact person he's most terrified of.
This is exactly why these arguments are so incredibly impossible to resolve. Because in that kitchen, they are both objectively right.
That's the crazy part.
He says, I have to do everything myself. You are completely unreliable. And he has a mountain of evidence to prove it. She really did forget the bread.
And she says, you are a suffocating control freak who never gives me any space. And she's also completely right. Neither of them concede that they built this prison together.
They are trapped in a script they didn't consciously write, playing roles they didn't choose.
And this exposes a glaring flaw in modern self-help culture, if you think about it.
How so?
Well, you see couples trapped in this projective identification go to therapy, and they are told to use I statements. They are told to say, I feel overwhelmed when the bread is forgotten instead of you forgot the bread.
Right.
But if they are stuck in this unconscious, shadowy script, focusing on polite phrasing is absurd. It's just giving them better lines to play their fake characters more perfectly.
I completely agree. If you focus only on the technique of the communication, you are treating surface-level symptoms while the underlying shadow script is allowed to run completely wild. You're polishing the dialogue of a terrible play instead of rewriting the story.
Now, we act like this is a relatively new phenomenon because we have all these clinical terms for it from the 1940s, but human beings have been destroying their relationships with this exact mechanism forever, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. Literature mapped this psychological terrain long before clinicians ever got involved.
Tell me more about that.
Well, Werner's essay highlights two major literary figures who captured this perfectly, Max Frisch and Gustave Flaubert. Frisch actually took the biblical commandment, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, and applied it directly to romance.
Oh, that's powerful.
It is. He argued that the moment you fix a rigid, finished image of your partner in your mind, you essentially stop loving them.
Because you aren't leaving any room for them to surprise you or to grow or to change. You press them into a mold until they obey it, and you become partially responsible for who they become.
Yes, it's an invisible kind of violence, really.
And what about Flaubert?
Flaubert takes a different angle. He shows the violence we do to ourselves. In his masterpiece, Madame Bovary, the main character, Emma, spends her youth devouring highly dramatized fictional romance novels.
Okay.
So she constructs a towering, impossible ideal of what sweeping, life-saving passion should look like. And when she marries a totally normal, average, everyday country doctor, she is utterly unequipped for a banal reality.
So what does she do?
To escape it, she projects her fictional romantic heroes onto completely ordinary men in her town.
And I'm guessing every time she does this, the projection inevitably shatters against the reality of these flawed, average men.
Exactly. And it completely destroys her life. The philosopher Jules de Gaultier was actually so struck by this dynamic that he coined the term Bovarism. Oh. Yes. It is the tragic tendency to project fictional romantic ideals onto banal, everyday people, and to mistake yourself and others for something you are not.
Wait, if Emma Bovary lost her mind over a stack of 19th century paperback romance novels, aren't we currently living in a psychological minefield?
What do you mean?
Think about dating apps, curated Instagram feeds, and, like, TikTok couples. They act as prepackaged, flawless, frictionless projection screens. Emma Bovary actually had to use her imagination to build an ideal.
That's a terrifying point.
Right. We just open our phones and an algorithm feeds us a billion high-definition images of perfect jawlines, perfect vacations, and perfect emotional regulation.
We demand that a real human being compete with an avatar that never gets tired, never gets annoyed, and never forgets the groceries. The gap between the projection and reality has never been wider.
And worse than that, the apps actively monetize our projections. Dating algorithms don't want you to find a messy, flawed human being and settle down.
Because if you do that, they lose a user.
Exactly. The entire business model relies on keeping your ideal perfectly polished on the screen. So you keep projecting an impossible, algorithmically enhanced super ideal onto the sweating, stuttering, completely real person sitting across from you on a first date.
No wonder everyone is so profoundly disappointed.
We are suffering from algorithmic bovarism.
Wow. Yes. The screens we project onto today are high resolution and inescapable.
Mm.
It just makes the task of recognizing a real person that much harder.
Given all this, I mean, if you're standing in the kitchen right now, how do you know if you're actually projecting or if your partner just genuinely messed up? We don't want to pathologize every single disagreement about chores.
That's a crucial distinction. Werner provides three practical warning signs to help you diagnose when a projection is actively hijacking your relationship.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first flag is usually the scale of it, disproportion. The emotional reaction is vastly bigger than the trigger. If a missed phone call makes you feel like your entire worth as a human being has been discarded, you are reacting to an old ghost, not just a missed call.
The size of the explosion doesn't match the size of the spark. Got it. But what if it's not just an isolated blow-up? What if you feel like you keep dating the exact same person, just with different faces?
That leads directly to the second warning sign. Repetition. And this requires difficult self-reflection. If you find yourself in the exact same toxic dynamic across three completely different relationships, for example, if you are always the only responsible adult in the room, while your partners consistently act like chaotic children,
then it is statistically unlikely that you just have terrible luck. You are the common denominator.
Exactly. You're unconsciously casting them in that role and essentially directing the play.
The hardest part for me, though, is feeling like I just know why my partner did something. Like, when they sigh a certain way, I feel like I can read their mind.
And that brings up the most dangerous trap of all, the third warning sign. Certainty. The illusion of telepathy. It is the moment you are 100% convinced that you know exactly what your partner's malicious inner motives are. You think, you did that just to make me look stupid in front of my friends, or you didn't buy the bread because you fundamentally don't respect my time.
Why do our brains jump so quickly to those malicious conclusions, though?
It comes down to cognitive dissonance. When a partner's action is ambiguous, maybe they were just distracted when they sighed, your brain panics.
Because the nervous system hates uncertainty, right? A vacuum feels like a threat.
Exactly. So to resolve the panic, the brain grabs a familiar, painful script, like, they think I'm stupid. A known painful script feels infinitely safer to your nervous system than pure unknown ambiguity.
So you fill in the blanks of their intentions with your own deepest insecurities.
Yes. When you possess that ironclad certainty about the dark workings of someone else's soul, you should stop immediately. You are rarely looking into their mind. You are almost always looking into a mirror at your own fears.
So what does this all mean for us? Because now that we have all this vocabulary, you know, the shadow, collusion, bovarism, it is going to be incredibly tempting the next time you're arguing about the dishes to point your finger and shout, you're just projecting your shadow onto me.
Oh, you absolutely cannot do that.
No.
That is the quickest way to weaponize this psychology and destroy any remaining trust. Real boundary crossing, deceit, and chronic unreliability are objective facts.
Yeah.
They are not projections. If someone is truly mistreating you, that is real.
Right. Because if you weaponize the term projection mid-argument, you are actually just projecting your own desire to be flawless.
Spot on.
You're basically saying, I am perfect. Any problem you have with me is just a delusion in your own broken brain. You just dump all the blame back onto them.
Using the word projection as a shield against legitimate criticism is a massive projection in itself. Projection is a tool for self-interrogation, never a weapon for partner interrogation.
So how do we actually diffuse it then? If you are caught in this web of projective identification, playing these fake roles and driving each other crazy, how do you break the cycle without just accusing the other person?
There's a psychological tool to break the cycle. It's called the take back. Jung believed that whatever is projected can be taken back.
How does that work?
The beauty of this is that you do not have to absolve your partner of their real faults. If they forgot the bread, they still forgot the bread. You don't have to pretend you aren't annoyed.
Right.
But before you launch your next character assassinating attack, you stop and you ask yourself one brutally honest question. Which part of this scene belongs to me?
Which part of this belongs to me? That is powerful.
And maybe it's only 10%. Maybe you realize, okay, they forgot the bread, which is mildly annoying. But my feeling of total devastating abandonment, that belongs to me. That's my shadow acting up.
And the moment you take back even a fraction of your own projection, the entire script breaks.
Exactly.
You stop feeding them the lines.
They no longer feel the suffocating pressure to inhabit the role you assign them. You stop projecting the movie onto them, and suddenly the screen becomes a real breathing person again. You allow them to be, as Max first said, unfinished.
The most empowering thing about this is that you don't need your partner to have some massive epiphany alongside you. You don't need to drag them to a couples retreat.
No, you don't.
The second you own your piece of the shadow, the entire dynamic shifts. You have the power to break the endless loop all by yourself just by dropping your half of the rope. It requires immense humility, but it is the only path to encountering a real person instead of boxing with your own shadow.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We've spent this entire deep dive examining the unfair, impossibly perfect, or deeply flawed images that we force onto our partners.
Yeah.
We talk about how modern algorithms feed us these flawless ideals that destroy our appreciation for real, sweating, stuttering reality.
It's an incredibly heavy burden to put on someone else's shoulders.
But turn that lens around for a second. Think about that algorithmic perfection. What impossible, flawless, totally unforgiving image are you projecting onto yourself every single morning when you look in the mirror?
Oh, wow.
Under what tyrannical script are you forcing yourself to live? And who could you actually become if you finally decided to step out of that projection and let yourself be a little unfinished, too?
So next time you're standing in the kitchen fuming over the dishes, maybe that's the real question to ask.